Chapter 89. Darrow. The Only Path. It is a crime how easy it is to forget home and those you love when you are at war. I used to feel guilty for how seldomly Pax would cross my mind. Usually it was only in a quiet moment before sleep or waiting for the shower water to grow hot. I would bring him mementos from distant battlefields as a way of proving he was in my thoughts. To him, to myself, to Virginia, even to our household servants. One of his favourite mementos was from the Himalayas on Earth, a gold commando captain whose name I forget had a curious collection of glass globes that I discovered after relieving the man of his head. Inside the globes were tiny models of cities. Some had weather that shifted with the seasons. The one I brought home was a city trapped in perpetual winter. I spent much of the idle hours in the Ra bunker, recovering from my shoulder injury, finishing my memoirs to Pax, and telling him more and more about Cassius. That is probably why, as I emerged from the mouth of the Ra bunker 3 weeks after Lysander's attack on the Garter, I think of that globe city and its fantastical buildings. Most of the atmospheric generators that allowed the bounty of the Garter to blossom and flourish on this hellish moon were destroyed in the 2-day bombardment. But not all of them. Not Plutus's. The Atmogens were stationed beneath its everlasting defensive shield, and though he could have, Lysander didn't bother to send men to destroy them. As a result, a new climate has emerged. Ash snows down on the buildings, on the blackened trees, on the barren fields where it gathers in drifts that shift with the wind much like the sea. The air is cold, and those who bundle themselves against it move hunched like mourners across a solemn winter landscape. The gold of wheat, the green of corn, the purple of plum, the red of pomegranate, the blue of berry bushes, far as the eye can see, has all been washed grey. But not all is lost. Overhead, dark rip wings perforate a cloud and bank toward the mass of a jade-green warship that hovers over the dead city. More ships trundle to the east and west along the ashen band Loon has made of the Garter. The spotlights carve through the grimness, searching for more survivors. It is only a fragment of the efforts Volga has made to help the people of Io, and Volga's contributions are only a piece of the puzzle. Even though they might help spot survivors, Volga is wise enough to keep her obsidians on their ships. Instead, smaller figures skip across the landscape like hares. The daughters are not freshly arrived. They came to help a day after Lysander departed. It's taken them weeks to find and uncover the collapsed bunker entrances. Until today, we were trapped beneath the surface of Io. At Plutus alone, I spot 10 hearthcraft offering medical aid to refugees. These craft may be painted raw black, but the hastily sprayed red owls on their wings mark the emergence of Athena and her daughters as something far more important in the Rim's political landscape than rebels or terrorists. Standing by my side, Diomedes watches the daughters' hearthcraft with mixed feelings. His grandmother's face is far less conflicted. Sour and humbled, she scowls at the hearthcraft, only to shoot a glare at an Athenian frigate parked on a hill where apples once grew.
"Are we to kiss their feet now, and thank them for stealing our ships that might have made the difference against fire?" she says. "We'll see how long that lasts when the Shadow Armada arrives."
It's that sort of talk that makes me fear this moment of idealism will be washed away by realpolitik before too long. All my hopes rest on Diomedes and his fabled honour. It is precarious to put so much faith in one man, but no more precarious than putting my faith in Volga. So much balances on the good intentions of dangerous people. It's enough to give a man grey hair.
"I do not kiss feet,"
Diomedes says, after a long moment. He scans the Moon Lords, seeing similar sentiments in their ranks.
But I will clasp hands. I thought Loon didn't use any atomics,
Gaia says. He didn't need to, I say.
Then what is that mutant?
She says, and points to a strange figure descending a building riven down its centre by an orbital strike. The figure leaps from one side of the fissure to the other before bounding our way. I run toward him, and he stops, taking off his helmet, and opens his arms for a hug. I slam into him, and cling to him, and Sevro hugs me back.
Cassius, I say. I know.
I break down, and Sevro holds me, hard, not humouring me, but clinging to me too. I know Cassius always rubbed him the wrong way, but when I pull back I see tears in his eyes.
I'll miss the prick, he admits. I'll miss him a lot.
Sevro smells terrible, and like home. He presses his forehead to mine.
We saw the bombardment from halfway across Ilium. I wanted to come straight off, but Athena and Volga wouldn't join their fleets.
Lyria worked on Volga, I worked on Athena. Finally, we agreed to move in concert, but Loon didn't stick around to give battle.
He's more afraid of Atalantia than he is of us, I say.
We'll make him pay for that.
Damn right.
I tousle his warhawk. When he finally pulls back, he glares at Diomedes.
You idiot! What do you think this is? The Middle Bloody Ages? The only thing Loons honour is themselves. You had that piece of shit in your grasp. Bologna. This. It's all on you, man.
Diomedes holds out his hand and closes it over the ash that falls on it.
It would appear the lesson is learned.
Glad Bologna could pay for your education, fool,
Sevro growls.
This man is the hegemon of the Dominion now, Gaia says. The Moon Lords have resurrected Akari's post for him. Show due respect. He is to be referred to as...
Sevro turns on Gaia.
Shut up, crone! I know all about you. Athena's educated me.
He spies armoured figures descending from the Pandora and stalks toward the frigate on the hill.
Best not keep your saviours waiting.
Gaia stares after him, then at Volga and her descending entourage, as the way Caesar might have regarded Gauls entering the Forum with weapons.
Is this why we lived? To ally with beasts?
If Mars does not feed us, we will starve, or else crawl to Loon,
Diomedes says.
So, yes.
When we reach the hill, Volga and Athena wait on either side of a square table charred black during the bombardment. The two women are a study in opposites. Athena wears her helmet, but also the oil-smeared jumpsuit of a labourer, and stands with a slouch. Volga has become a warrior queen in image, if not yet in proof. A mane of blue feathers flows from her shining silver war helm. I'm disgusted to see Far's warsaw clings to the magholster on her back. Yet Volga's face, when she doffs her helmet, is covered in a mask of ash. She is bald, too. I search for Lyria amongst the titans of her entourage and spot her soot-stained hands folded in front of her. It was not Volga's idea to wear the ashes and so come bearing her shame on her face, but the fact that Lyria thought of it and convinced her means far more to me. She looks at me in pain, and her eyes start to well up. Somewhere, maybe in the void or the veil, Cassius would smile to see his accidental protege is yet again more than meets the eye. Then Diomedes, of all people, starts the meeting off on a bad note.
You are to come unarmed, he says.
Volga is unimpressed.
You live by my mercy.
You rose by my aid, he says.
They glare at each other until Volga shrugs, draws the warsaw, and breaks it over her knee. An impossible act if it hadn't already been weakened by a laser.
Premeditated, then.
She tosses the tip to Diomedes.
So you remember its edge.
She returns the hilt to the holster.
And who holds the grip?
Athena curses under her breath and looks at me as if I made these giants in my personal laboratory.
Shall we get to it before we kill each other, then?
She asks.
Ideally, I reply.
Diomedes, the Covenant. Four dustwalkers bring the Covenant to the table. The document is laser-etched into a hunk of iron several found in the rubble. It is a vague document and carries none of the reforms to the hierarchy that Diomedes agreed to in private, but it is consequential for five reasons. It provides dominion amnesty without expiration for all daughters of Athena, as well as promises of due process in legal proceedings for all colors. It pronounces the Volk's oath to never venture again beyond the asteroid belt. It formalizes a military alliance between the Republic and the Rim Dominion for a period of 10 years. And it binds all parties to a declaration of war on the society. Not Lysander, not Atalantia, not whomever rises if they fall, but the society itself. It does not solve all quarrels. The Dominion was refused a right to prosecute Volk braves and seek any restitution for their liberated obsidians. The Volk were not allowed to keep any spoils of victory save the Rim obsidians who wished to stay in the Volk host. Athena did not get the abolition of the hierarchy she desired, or ownership of the deep, yet. In the end, no one is happy, which means it is probably the only document anyone could sign, with even the slightest suspicion that it might actually be honored by the others. When drops of blood are taken from each signatory and sealed into the metal, Athena, Volga, and Diomedes stare at the iron tablet with an expression I know all too well. What have I done? Will it matter in the end? No. One of them will break the agreement. I should be ready. Those same thoughts play through my mind as the meeting threatens to dissolve with enough frigidity to make even an optimist fear the worst. Before each signatory can retreat to their people, I point to the iron tablet.
This means nothing. Not to us. We all know it.
But it will mean something to people who weren't here, if we let it. I don't know what we'll find when we return to the core, whether Mars stands or not, whether there will even be a Republic Navy left to rendezvous with us. But I do know this. One way or another, this war will not last the year. A reckoning is coming, either for the tyrants or for us. We are weaker. We are fewer. The only advantage we have is that they can't afford to trust one another. We can't afford not to.
May I say something?
We all turn to the interloper.
It is Ori.
Standing with the daughters behind Athena, she takes off her scarf and goggles. Diomedes smiles softly. I motion her forward.
In the garden where I was raised, we are taught to study people like flowers. Many pinks are not destined for high halls and must know how to sense dark intentions even behind the kindest eyes. When I look at you, I sense you are all growing toward the light. There is something sacred in that, because you all represent a people. People who yearn for something more. For something they've never had. Loon, Grimace, they are trying to reclaim what they have lost. Control. There is nothing sacred in that. They do not lead. They pull. They corral. They confine. Their path has only room for one. Your path has room for you all. Remember that. And from this ash, freedom will grow. On that note, the meeting adjourns. Volga returns to her jarls. Lyria jerks her head at Severo and me to join. I nod at her dirty forehead.
The ash didn't go unnoticed by the Moonies.
Well done.
Volga grimaces. There is more to do before it is washed clean. Darrow, I am sorry about your friend, Cassius. He was the most handsome man I have ever seen.
Lyria snorts.
Severo rolls his eyes. He was. A warrior must tell the truth, and I hear he was very kind. I wish I could have known him better.
Loon will die. He has broken Lyria's heart. Whatever you need, when the time comes.
Thank you, Volga.
I look at Lyria. She's wiping her eyes.
He was quite fond of you, I say. She doesn't let me console her. She bull-rushes me and hugs my hips. I peel her off and kneel and take a real hug.
He was really pure, she says. I'm so sorry, Darrow. He loved you. I'm sorry.
She pulls back and wipes her eyes.
Shit, this sucks.
Not long after, Volga returns to the Pandora with Lyria, as Severo and I say our goodbyes to Athena, Ori, and Diomedes.
The fleets of the giants are well underway,
Diomedes says.
Uranus will try to hit the outbound Ascomani ships and return our stolen peoples. Neptune is across the sun and will meet us in the core. Once the Shadow Armada meets me here, we will meet you at the rendezvous.
I won't be able to wait long, I say. Our ships are fast. Maybe we will beat you there.
He grasps my hand, and then surprises Severo by extending his hand to him as well. Severo looks at it in suspicion.
Don't be late again, Severo says. Don't torture me again.
Severo shakes Diomedes' hand as quickly as possible.
I will see you in Sungrave, Diomedes asks Ori.
I've seldom been able to look at people and realize they are in love. With Diomedes and Ori, it is so obvious even the Ash knows. They are a strange, shadowy pair. One raw iron, the other moonlit glen. But people probably think Virginia and I are an odd pair as well.
Ori squeezes Diomedes' hand. He nods to me and returns to his people.
I'm functioning as his emissary to the daughters before he sails for the core, Ori says.
Of course you are, Severo says.
Athena grimaces after Diomedes.
Since I'm sending our fleet with you, Darrow, if his people turn on us, they'll be able to wipe us out in a week, she says.
But they won't, Ori says. They need us too, now.
You sure you don't want to come with? Severo asks Athena. Just in case.
I am not a warrior, and this is my home. The people need me more now than ever.
Chion will have to do, she replies.
If that's the case... I unwrap Pyrphoros from my arm. Ori laughs.
Athena ignores the blade and peers up at the falling ash.
The garter will take decades to rebuild. Without the croplands of the core, we'll starve out here. Maybe not this year, but the one after. Ra knows it. I know it. So you have to win, lads. Martian grain, Martian fruit, Martian cows and pigs. That's your sentence. Feed us, and don't break all my ships.
With a nod to Ori, she turns to head back to the refugee camp. Severo bumps Ori's shoulder with a fist.
We'll miss your songs, he says. For a while they were the only thing that could make me feel anything.
Without waiting for a reply, he swivels away and heads for the Pandora.
I face Ori. It's been a journey, I mumble. I wanted to say thank you. For bringing us here. For giving me the path to the Vale. I was spiraling. People have saved my life before, but I think you saved my soul.
And you saved Cassius's, she says. It wasn't me that did it. I liked him very much. In another life I might have loved him. But he didn't need a woman's love. He needed a brother's. The way he talked about you, well... Her eyes swim with tears. Lysander was an obligation. You were an aspiration. He was so afraid on our journey to the core, so nervous to see you and be rejected. But when he saw you respected him, valued him, he shined like a star. His path led back to you, because you made him feel loved. That is all that matters, Darrow. When he died, he knew he was loved. So when you think of him, when you feel sad, remember that. She kisses me on the cheek. If we do not meet again, I will see you in the Vale with Cassius. You know the path.
It is a strange, mismatched fleet that departs Aya. Not just because the Obsidian ships are hulking juggernauts while the Athenian vessels are lean lightning. It is the people on the ships, too. The ships the daughters stole or built themselves are understaffed and, while rich with crafty specialists and brigades of black owls, are short of meaningful infantry that can challenge the Ash Legions. The Obsidian ships, while rich with quality infantry, are riven by animosity between the crews and the returning Volk. The blues and oranges and reds on those ships will never forget the treatment they faced under Farr's rule, nor should they. Once they were hired contractors serving under Sephi's generous hand, then they were slaves again to the very braves who called them colleagues. Only my tearful petition, the threat to Mars and Volga's immediate reforms keep the low-color crews from using their newfound freedom to sabotage or abandon the ships. Still, I imagine most of them will hate the Obsidians for the rest of their lives. It is good Lysander did not want to fight our fleet. We have no cohesion yet, and would have lost despite our advantage in numbers. I hope on the journey home, Severo and I can form the ragtag fleet into a fighting force that can combine with the Republic ships not grounded on Mars to help turn the tide. I know it will be an uphill struggle. On a journey full of surprises, it seems the Rim has yet one more in store for us. 12 hours out from Io, we receive a hail from a ship that the Pandora's scanners cannot see. It is the Archimedes. My heart is heavy as I walk toward the ship with Severo. Each step up the ramp reminds me of a friend I've lost. Io, thunk. Ragnar, thunk. Orion, thunk. Dancer, thunk. There are less steps to reach the top of the ramp than I have dead friends to list. They all drift away when I enter the ship with Severo. It is empty and quiet. The inspection teams have come and gone. If Lysander left a trap, it is in human form. Pytha, the former co-pilot of the Archimedes and former captain of the Lightbringer, waits for me in the Pandora's brig. Severo lets me enter alone. I wander. I see Cassius everywhere I go, hunched over its controls in the cockpit, pretending not to be nervous, navigating its halls with his two wide shoulders, giving his toast in the commissary, grinning down at me from the training room as he puts me on the floor again. And when I stand before the door to his room, the only room in the ship I've never been inside, I feel his absence. The cold of the ship. And I know I have to face him. Cassius's body is stored in the cargo hold. He lies within a funeral torpedo stamped with the sigil of his house. Lysander's last grace for a man who became his surrogate father, brother, family. Cassius is dressed in his favorite pale blue tunic with the ink stain on the cuff and a storm cloak. His family razor lies spooled on his chest. His face and hands have been cleaned and dressed with preserving oils. but the wounds and contusions and the purple kiss of the rope cannot hide the violent way he met his end. He hardly looks like the same man I knew. My hand trembles as it touches his hair, the only part of him that escaped the brutality of Lysander. His hair is no less golden now that he is dead. A single sob comes out of me, followed by tears and silence. Cassius had a heart like Io, though it took him longer to find it. I wish he'd found it sooner. I don't know how long I stand there thinking not of the past, but all the life he had yet to live now that he'd become the man I always hoped he would be. Footsteps bring me back into my body. I hurt all over. I wipe my face and look up to see Severo. He looks at Cassius with the same annoyance he first looked at him 16 years ago. The Blue says he killed Atlas. A poor trade, I reply. Yut. Bloody damn Bologna. The man who killed Fear. Guys, we're going to hear that song in all the bars when we're fat and old. Shit. Is that... He walks to the far wall and holds up a helmet. Das main helm? He shoves it on his head. Fits like a glove. Man, still stinks like Fitch, too. He turns to me. I just realized it could be booby-trapped. I had them check the helmet, Severo. Good. Phew. Ugh, the thought of loons snooping in my room. Disgusting. He goes quiet and takes the helmet off. He looks down at it, one of his only mementos of his father, then puts it with Cassius between his feet. He touches Cassius's leg and grows somber. I don't know if I've ever loved Severo more than I do in the depths of his silence. We stand quiet a few minutes before he closes the coffin's lid. He nods for me to follow him. Found something. I follow Severo to Cassius's room. The door is open. I feel anger towards Severo for violating Cassius's sanctum. Then I see the cramped room into which Cassius fit his huge life. On one wall, his childhood, filled with moving pictures of Eagle Rest, Julian, his father, his brothers, his sisters, even his mother, all curly-haired and smiling. There are a few swordsmanship badges and mementos whose meaning will never now be known. A purple stone with flecks of gold. A chunk of metal the size of an apple. A carved length of wood. A large knife with an eagle-shaped pommel. On another wall hangs a House Mars pendant, surrounded by printed news clippings of my pack. Not just me, but Severo, Screwface, Clown, Pebble, Virginia, even Pax. They are all happy moments, and it makes me sad that he couldn't be there to share them with us. On the third wall are images of Lysander, Pytha, and Cassius through the years. But it's the hollow projector that makes me stare. A lock floats in the air filled with two shivering boys, while a wolf-like creature slinks around its edges. Looked through his deck to see what the creep liked to wank it to, Severo says. He picks up the eagle knife and pockets it. He's got hundreds of hours of Institute footage in here. Some people peek too early. He winces. Sorry. He'd get that. He sighs and takes a seat in Cassius's lone chair and nods to the floor. I take a seat. He plops his hand on my shoulder. It's a long trip home. Where should we start? Wherever he left off, I say. Together, now at the age of many of the proctors who watched our antics from Olympus, we watch the three boys ride their horses across a moonlit plain. The boys were us once. Drunk on victory, they carried an owl standard and howled like idiots at the moons. We were idiots. Trapped in a world of lies, Maybe the howls were the truest things that came out of our mouths. We were all just lonely and in search of a pack. I've already tried a tight beam to Mars. I don't know if they received my message. So I take Pax's key in my hands and send a silent message to Virginia and my boy. I love you. I am coming home. I have an army. I have an armada. We will win. For Io, for Ragnar, for Fichtner, for Cassius. For them all.